Okay, wow, that is obviously Cardi B's Bodak Yellow, and I am listening to it by request of the one and only Bevo.
Hello, everyone.
Yes, and I am with B. We are at her restaurant, Boondocks, which is on City Road.
Yes, it is, near Old Street.
And having, I guess, if Cardi B was a brunch.
Yes.
That's what we're having now.
That would exactly be it. From the biscuits and gravy, that's got a bit of spice to it. Hash browns, the, you know, huevos mitzvahs with the fried tortilla.
Yeah, that's
I think that's very Cardi B.
Okay,
for sure.
Yeah. So there's some intensity, some spice, some attitude.
It's just extra. It's extra. That's it. She's extra. This is extra. That's what it's all about.
All right. Well, I'm extra stoked to be here. B, I've known you for, we just established about 10 years.
Yes.
And when I met you, it was when you had just opened Bees of Bloomsbury, which was 10 years ago. Last month? This is the end of March, and you opened 10 years ago in February.
Yes. I remember that. You were the first... you were the first journalist to write about us and named us the best cupcakes in London.
Oh.
When I hadn't intended on serving cupcakes at Bees of Bloomsbury.
Uh-oh.
So that was the funny thing.
Oh, wow.
I remember that from ages ago. What happened was we were doing a press event. We thought, let's do a press event and let's invite, you know, various people to come. And I wanted to be known for whole cakes and doing kind of big, massive layer cakes.
Oops.
And someone was like, well, actually, you know, to make it easier for serving, we should just make cupcakes on the day so they can get a sense of what it's like. And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And then your line came out. It was like, best cupcakes in London. And then boom, it was just, we couldn't not keep them in stock.
So, wow. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Or you're welcome. I don't know. You take that either way. But wow. Well, you've come a long way from cupcakes.
Yeah.
So you had Bees for a number of years. You've moved on from it now, though.
Yes, I left about 4 years ago to open Stacks Diner, to kind of move into restaurants and see if a pastry chef could actually make a burger. So,
So pastry chef. So pre-Bees, even how did you come about?
So I trained at the small little French patisserie out in upstate New York. I was actually a student at Cornell University, studying biomedical ethics of all things. But I just found myself spending more time in the kitchen than I was at the library. I knew this is something I needed to kind of think about and pursue. So I went to Cordon Bleu for a summer course here in London.
Okay.
This would have been almost 20 years ago.
Okay.
Loved it. Went to my family, said, you know, I want to quit college and university and I want to be a chef. To which the first response was, you got flour on the ceiling when you were 9. But surprisingly, very supportive family, totally cool with me becoming a chef, which I was considering that, you know, I grew up in a very kind of tiger mom household, you know.
Okay.
You know, no TV, studying, work hard. So for me to kind of change into a blue-collar profession is quite... you know, yeah, I was just very surprised. So, finished my uni studies, you know, just in case you break your hip or something happens, or, you know, or that it might be a fad, you know, that
right.
So a lot of people want to say that they want to be a chef and then first year they flame out. So that could have totally happened to
me.
And in the meantime, I started off as a kitchen porter in this little tiny French patisserie in my college town in Ithaca, New York. And I happened to train...
So you get a degree in bio...
I do have a degree, yes.
What was it?
It's officially science and technology studies, but with a concentration in biomedical ethics.
So you get
pre-law.
This mega degree at Cornell.
Completely useless.
And then go ground level job at a little restaurant.
And I'm mopping floors, I'm deveining shrimp, I am cleaning toilets. That was my job.
Okay,
so,
wow.
Yeah. But I loved it. I loved every second of it.
Okay, oh my God. Wow, okay. So then you start Stacks.
Yes.
In 2014.
Yes.
Okay.
Which, I mean, it was a lot of fun. I mean, we ended up on a lot of best burgers lists, Harper's Bazaar, Glamour Mag. Adam Richman did a show with us for Secret Eats to highlight our Nutella Duffin Sunday. And it's just been packed ever since. It's even hard for me to get a table every now and then. Like, if I show up on a Thursday night and I want a table, that's not happening.
Like,
so,
who are you?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's an hour and a half wait. It's like, okay, I'm just going to go somewhere else now. So.
Okay, wow. So, were you just tired of making cupcakes or just really eager to make burgers? You wanted to try something new? You saw an opportunity?
You know, to be honest, it was more about working with people that I really wanted to work with. And so there was someone I met named David Ramsey, who I met through kind of mutual friends, who's just really kind of appreciated what it was that I did and what I do in terms of my food philosophy and how I wanted things to be.
Okay.
And to have that kind of support system, to have someone kind of be like, look, I can handle all the financials, all the logistics and planning, but you do what you do best, which is the creative and the operations, that's the way forward. And it's been a really good kind of partnership. And it was something where I wanted to kind of really just work with people I wanted to work with more than anything else. And then with the support of Riaz Shah, who's kind of like a family member to me, who also kind of pushed me to kind of pursue what, in terms of not just holding true to yourselves in terms of your principles with your philosophy, but then reaching out and finding people who support that philosophy. And so I've been extremely lucky to have that. You know, there are not a lot of backers or investors or business partners who will be okay with you saying, look, I really want Martin's potato buns. We need to ship 10 pallets worth from America over here. But trust me, it's worth it. Or, you know, to be like, you know, we really need to make our own ice creams for the milkshakes. You know, to not take those shortcuts. And so, yeah, just that's what I wanted more than anything else. And it was quite important to me. And David just wanted to start, I was like, hey, why don't we just start off with a burger bar, see what happens? Mm-hmm. And that's how it started out. So I was like, yeah, sure, why not?
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. And so, and then from that, you now have 4 restaurants in London.
Yes.
We're at, obviously, Boondocks. Uh-huh. You mentioned Stacks. There's also the Famous Flames.
Yeah, Famous Flames in Camden's. Best wings ever.
Best wings ever.
It's actually my favorite menu out of all the sites. It's
okay.
My favorite. Yep.
Okay. And then the latest one is Butterscotch.
Butterscotch, yep. So we
in
have
White City. Yeah.
In White City Place. And then we just opened a second location, which is a pop-up. Which is the Tea Room over on James Street, which is about a block away from Selfridges near Bond Street.
Yes, okay.
So
okay.
That just opened, yeah.
And those all fall under the umbrella of Soul Food Enterprises, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So I think Soul Food, I'm a Georgia boy, I think of the South, and you were
exactly.
Mentioning Cornell, but you're actually from Virginia.
I'm actually from Virginia,
okay.
Yes. So, I mean, my summer holidays were spent down in the Outer Banks in North Carolina, and I have family down South, and so for me, my Southern accent will come out when I'm very angry, apparently, is what I've been told.
Okay.
But I do have a little bit of one, if
that
makes sense.
Yeah, alcohol,
and I do,
anger, and excitement bring mine out.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah. So I say ain't a lot, which everyone gets, and y'all. I say y'all a lot.
Y'all's a great word.
Y'all's amazing.
Gender neutral.
And I'm just like, y'all need to, and people look at me, they have no idea what I'm saying, especially over here, just like, what, I don't even understand half the words coming out of her mouth sometimes.
Okay.
And then, of course, since I've been here for quite some time, a little bit of the South London terms have come in, so like, innit, I've picked up innit as well, so like, y'all need to pick up some stuff innit, and then it's like, you know, I'm just globalization, I am just combining cultures everywhere.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, everyone tells me here, well, you certainly haven't lost your accent, even though I've been here 14 years whatever.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, but I don't sound like I'm from Walker County anymore.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly. I mean, I have friends who come over from America, and they're like, you have a British accent. I said, nowhere would anyone on this island think that I have a British accent. But it's because I use the words mobile, flats,
lovely,
Lori, yeah, you know, sweetheart, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And it's, yeah, it's quite funny. It's quite amusing.
So, over here, why did you do this over here as opposed to New York State, Virginia, or anywhere else? Really.
Well, simply put, Bush got reelected. So,
okay.
So yeah, Bush got reelected, and I saw an opportunity to move to London, so I took it more than anything else.
Okay.
And I think I love London. You know, I've born and raised in Virginia, and I've never felt home in the way that I felt home here.
Okay.
If that made sense. You know, even back home, you know, during university break, most people would go home for Thanksgiving. I actually would stay in uni. You know, I'd be a resident advisor, so I'd make Thanksgiving dinner for, you know, all the stragglers left behind. But here is where every time I get on the plane and I'm heading, you know, towards the runway to London, mm-hmm. there's that sense of, oh, I'm home. And I never had that when I was in D.C., and I never had that when I was in upstate New York, and I never really had that on my holidays, vacations as a kid. only when I'm in London.
Okay.
And so, and I don't know how, I don't know why. It's not as if London was ever in my DNA until I came here for cooking school. So not until I was in my 19, 20. But yeah, it's for some reason, it's just the feeling I get.
Yeah. No, you know, I could have said almost exactly what you just said mm-hmm. about my experience here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can be away somewhere wonderful, feel like I left too soon.
Yep.
Be miserable, be a miserable day in London, but I'm mm-hmm. still like, okay, I'm home. This
yep.
is it, yeah. And there's still something there that really always amazes me about
exactly.
the city. Yeah. And you think London's taken to you? The folks here like your food?
I hope so. I mean, I think there's definitely be kind of a response, and I think it is because it is all heartfelt more than anything
okay.
else. It's not cleanly packaged. You know, there are a lot of concepts or a lot of places where they start off thinking about the name, then they start thinking about the design, then they start thinking about colors, and they start thinking about like all these things. And at the bottom of the list is, oh yeah, we need to hire a chef and come up with the menu.
Right, yeah.
And I work from completely the opposite direction.
Okay.
Mine is, what is the food that I want to eat growing up? What is the food, like, what's something that makes me happy? What, you know, the foods that I ate when I grew up as a kid, the foods that I ate that excite me. And so that combined with the fact that I kind of have the palate of a drunken frat boy, which is all about extra, extra flavor and lots of maybe fat. It starts from that first. The food is first, and then everything else follows.
Okay.
And I think a lot of chefs nowadays have started do that, especially the ones that are the chef owners, definitely do that. You know, if you look at Ross Shanahan from Bone Daddies, you look at James and Sandia Chang from Bubble Dogs in the Kitchen Table.
Okay.
For them, it was the food first and everything follows. And I think those who tend to follow in that fashion, it resonates with people.
Okay. So you said the food from home and the food you had growing up.
Yes.
So I see your menu and I get that.
Yes.
You've got the sort of, you can get a Bojangles biscuit
yep.
or a Hardee's biscuit.
Yes.
And
I have hash browns that remind you of the hash browns in the cafeteria when you were a kid.
Yes, totally.
Instead
yeah.
of the super refined ones where we could grate our own potatoes and make it ourselves. It's like, no, that's the one that yeah. I wanted. Yep.
They're yummy. But so do people get that here? Is there sort of a learning curve? They got to like teach them?
Like, yeah, there's definitely a learning curve. I mean, I used to have Sloppy Joe's on the menu
okay.
and that didn't survive. Chicken fried steak, also very confusing. People didn't understand when it would show up with beef. They were like, we don't, where's the chicken? And so it ended up having to be kind of altered. It's now chicken fried chicken to make that work.
Okay.
S'mores. So when we bring s'mores.
You do have good fried chicken here.
Thank you.
The only one other time I was here, it was amazing.
Thank you. So and then we do s'mores as a dessert on the menu, and it's hilarious because we bring out the fire. It's an actual fire.
Not really.
With the sticks and the marshmallows and our own homemade graham crackers, because you can't buy graham crackers in the UK, and the chocolate. And you see people, if you don't explain to them how to put it together, they will literally take the chocolate and try to put it over the flame and then like of course like start, you know,
yeah.
burning the chocolate. So
oh, yeah, yeah.
so of course, you know, we have to educate them in terms of this is what you do. Take the marshmallow, put it on the stick, toast the marshmallow, you know. So there's definitely a lot of things where you have to kind of educate the public as to exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
Famous Flames is the same way. I mean, we have Nashville hot wings
yeah.
and a Nashville hot sandwich on the menu, and they don't realize how hot it is until they have it. And it's quite funny because now I think David Chang came out with that new Netflix series, Ugly Delicious.
Yes.
And he did an
yeah.
episode about Nashville hot, so now
uh-huh.
that's becoming the new buzzword. I'm
yeah.
like, hey, I've had that on my menu for the past year and a
yeah,
half,
yeah,
and
sure,
no one's
yeah.
noticed.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of, like, I have General Tso's chicken. At Famous Flames.
Oh,
and
yummy.
No one has any idea what General Tso's chicken
really?
Is, you know? And so, but I wanted to have that on my menu because that's what I grew up with. I mean,
okay.
I grew up eating General Tso's chicken with my sister and ordering the fried rice. And my sister has this tradition, which I've kind of kept on, where she would sneak in Chinese food into the movie theaters. And and like the white containers and chopsticks.
That's awesome.
And so I have to say, I do the exact same thing here.
Okay.
So if you're ever in a movie theater and you think you're smelling like lo mein or fried rice, I'm probably in the theater with you, just FYI.
Wow. Okay.
But it's just something I've kind of held on to.
I hold you at a whole new level of esteem now, Bea. That's impressive. Wow. I thought I was being cheeky with like pistachios from the shop.
No,
or
no,
something.
No.
Yeah.
I will carry bags of like roast duck and like bones and everything and just start chewing on it, and I got my chopsticks out
oh
and
my God.
I'm just ready to go.
Okay, wow. I'm impressed. I might need a bib to do that in the dark, watching a movie, but I am inspired. You mentioned that you sort of slid it in there a few minutes ago. You mentioned the Duffin.
The Duffin, yes. Yes.
Can you
know, it's one of those things I pray does not end up on my tombstone when I die.
Okay.
Which I think so far, hopefully, it's just a period in my life, and it is as it was.
Okay.
Which is good. But yeah, this is a weird one. I made the Duffin long before Duffingate was an issue. It was actually...
what is it?
Duffin is a donut muffin hybrid. So it's a cross between a donut and a muffin. And I will say, right off the bat, I did not invent the Duffin. So the Duffin had been in existence long before I was. I think even Nigella Lawson had it in her original cookbook.
Okay.
But not in the same format as my style. So my style is, it was filled with nutmeg, filled with raspberry jam, has buttermilk in it, and then it's dipped entirely in melted butter, and then rolled in cinnamon sugar. So my inspiration for my version of the Duffin came from Amish country. So when I was a kid, we used to go and visit all the donut shops on the way to Lancaster County from home. And there'd be tons of places that would have cake donuts as well as sour cream donuts. So if you ever had a sour cream donut in the States, the sour cream, what it does to the donut is it kind of almost breaks the structure apart. So you have all these like grooves and crevices and these massively large bubbles. It's a very uneven, airy texture consistency crumb inside it. And it's just crispy. It's like crispy and covered in sugar, and it's all sorts of goodness. And then I also just love cake donuts. I love cinnamon. So cinnamon and nutmeg are my two favorite.
Cinnamon is very American.
Yes.
I don't know if people realize that or not, but
yes.
It's such an American flavor.
You can't escape it. And same with nutmeg. Nutmeg for me, I love nutmeg. I feel like it grounds everything. And so I love cake donuts for that reason. So I wanted the texture of a sour cream donut, and I wanted the taste of a cake donut. And so that was my, and then I filled it with raspberry jam because I know that over in the UK, donuts aren't donuts unless they're filled with something. So custard or jam,
okay.
I picked jam. And so we put it out on the counter at St. Paul's, and we put it out on the counter at Theobald's Road, and we called them donut muffins. That was the name. And then customers actually started calling them Duffins. But like, Duffin, like, can I just, so we just changed it, called it a Duffin, called it a day. Didn't think much about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was in my cookbook. The recipe was actually in my cookbook saying it's a donut muffin. It says very clearly in the recipe, it says, this is a great blog idea. Here's my take on it. So again, not the inventor of the Duffin. So what happened was years later, this was the year that the Cronut became extremely popular.
Yeah, I remember that.
I think everyone was trying to come up with their own hybrid desserts,
mm-hmm.
Portmanteau. I remember at one point, I think Greg's had come out with Muff Nuts. So it was their version of the donut muffin, but just really the most tragic name they could come up with was Muff Nuts. And I think what was it? There's the croissant muffin one, which I can't remember what name. Creffin came out.
Creffin, okay.
We did the Townie with Evening Standard, so that was a brownie tart. I remember that was quite popular for a while. And then Starbucks apparently comes out with something called a Duffin. And it happened to have things like nutmeg. Nutmeg and buttermilk and raspberry jam.
Oh my God.
And that's when you start to see, wait a second, you know, they could have easily created like a chocolate peanut butter Duffin. They could have done anything, like
an apple one,
vanilla glaze, a strawberry. They could have gone anywhere, but to have specifically, and in the PR, in the press release, specifically to say, got raspberry jam, got buttermilk and nutmeg. Nutmeg was clearly, I know that's my spice. I know that's me. It was clear that they had copied it from me, took it from my cookbook. One hand was not talking to the other, which is AKA the product development team over at Rich's Product, which is a Starbucks distributor, was not listening to, the marketing department were not in contact with each other and didn't realize that they had ripped it off from my cookbook. And then, of course, ended the press release. And at the time, the Duffin already had gotten quite a bit of praise. It was in GQ magazine, it was in NPR, it was in Evening Standard. It wasn't like it wasn't a known product. So I didn't know anything about this because I obviously don't follow what Starbucks does on a daily basis in my life. It's just, just me. And then all of a sudden it kind of just blew up on Twitter. All of a sudden I started getting all these messages on my phone.
Now we're at Duffin Gate.
Now we're at Duffin Gate. where people are like, hey, wait a second, Starbucks, you didn't, because Starbucks had the gall to basically say, we invented this new dessert. And then people kind of called them out on it and said, well, actually, no, you didn't. And so that's when we kind of stepped in. The part that made it, you know, yes, sometimes marketing companies mess up, sometimes corporations mess up, not a big deal. The part about this that made it kind of fractious or made it potentially dangerous for us was that Starbucks had trademarked the name Duffin, which meant legally they could prevent us from selling and making the very thing that they stole from us. And that's where they stepped into the, oh no, you didn't, territory, right? It's like, oh no, you didn't. Okay, now like the nail's got to come off, the hair's coming off, like, you know, this is what's happening. So I just remember getting like phone calls, like, you know, phone calls from Ian McCrann at the time, who was the head of Starbucks marketing, wanting to have chats with me.
In the words of Cardi B, what, bitch?
Yeah, there was. Okay, it was exactly. It's like, okay, if you want to, let's do this. Okay. So, you know, and he, I remember they called me and they're like, yeah, we'd love to chat with you over the phone. And I said, no, to be honest, anything that is said between us two needs to be in writing. Because, like, I'm not going to fall into this game of, you know, anything else. At the end of it, you know, they backed down, said, yes, we're aware that other places made stuff. And then what was more important to me than any of that was that by no means would we go after anyone for using the word Duffin in anything.
And that, like, I have a, like, well, I don't, I guess, it was there was a Vietnamese restaurant in London that kind of tried to trademark a very generic term recently.
Yes, you know, and pho. And, you know, the thing about that is that, for example, you cannot trademark the name Duffin in the U.S. So the U.S. Intellectual Property Office was smart enough to see Duffin is a fairly generic term. You cannot really trademark this name because it's a fairly generic term.
Cheeseburger, pizza, sandwich.
Exactly. And for some reason, I don't know why the UK IPO does not follow the same thing. Also, you know, it is a kind of a cultural base, especially for something like the name pho, which is like taco or like pizza. Had it been like pho plus something else, totally could see that. But the word by itself, I just, it's very unusual, but for some reason it passed through the IPO office here in the UK. And for some reason the Duffin passed through the IPO in the UK. And it has a lot to do with kind of, you know, the whatever their threshold is for what is considered to be a generic term is very, I don't know where that threshold is, but apparently as long as if it's not classically a British thing like treacle or if it's not a British word, then yep, you can trademark it. And I think that's kind of a bit,
what
bit
on
weird.
Earth is a Duffin?
Yeah, like I have no idea what a Duffin is, so sure, let's trademark it. And it's just like, hold on a second. Like, So in any case, the best part of it was the fact that what I wanted more than anything else is I didn't want some small, cute little bakery out in Liverpool or out in Devon who wanted to make a Duffin, like use the recipe from their cookbook or any other, or make their own, whatever it was, and then get a cease and desist letter from Starbucks. Because we have to remember, Starbucks, you know, despite their...
Yeah, right or wrong, they've got the money and the
legal... And they have had a history in the U.S. of going after people for their trademarks. And for example, they went after a monastery, I think it was in California, who every year they sell a Christmas blend coffee, right? And they sell it for mail order, and it's a monastery, people. Right. A monastery. These cute little monks, like, just happily packaging some coffee beans and giving them out to people and selling them. And Starbucks sends a cease and desist letter because they had happened to trademark the words Christmas blend coffee.
Right?
Those three words in combined, and this monastery was using it, and Starbucks went after them. So this is where I had the issue with Duffin. I honestly don't care if people want to copy my recipes or whatever else. That's why I wrote a cookbook. If you want to, like, you know, make your own triple chocolate cake, you want to make your own Duffin, your own townie, whatever it is, go for it. Because the whole point for me is I want people to enjoy good food, right? So if you're making something that's amazing out there, I'm going to be very happy for you. I have no sense in terms of this is my product and I'm going to hold on to it. And it's my, you know, the whole point of food culture and the reason why innovation is important. And 99% of the time, you'll get duds, right? Like, you know, Dorito taco, for example, for me is just an abomination. And I love Doritos and I love tacos. So, but at the same time, like, food culture and culture in general needs to progress. There needs to be change. There needs to be, and you need to build on that foundation. And you can't do that by saying, well, I've invented this and no one else can have it. Caesar salad, great example, right? Great waiter, in Las Vegas or Nevada, wherever he is.
I heard it was Tijuana.
Tijuana. Oh. So it's like, here, let's get some anchovies, let's get some like egg, let's get some, you know, lemon juice and like some, you know, some romaine lettuce and make a salad of it. And it's amazing. And could you imagine if you trademarked the name? And so that way, if someone wants to make that exact same salad somewhere else, they'd have to call it some ridiculous other name. No, I think, so that's my take on the whole Duffin thing.
Excellent, wow. Well, you're talking about Duffin, I'll be honest.
Yep.
I'm thinking about hash browns.
So yes.
I sort of let that go just because I kept like nibbling at these awesome hash browns. I got a stack of hash browns here. They're delicious. So, what's the name of your cookbook?
Oh, that was years ago. It's Tea with B,
right.
Which was the original one. I wrote it back in, 2009, 2010?
Okay.
Can't even remember. So it's quite some time ago.
Okay.
The second cookbook is in the works.
Oh.
That will be based on Butterscotch Bakery.
Okay.
And kind of my new style philosophy on things, which hasn't changed, fundamentally hasn't changed, but just kind of incorporating some new styles. Like we do this incredible vegan gluten-free cake, carrot cake, at Butterscotch. And anytime anyone's ever had it, they have no idea that they're missing anything in it. It's just a fully complete cake. And I just like to make cakes and treats and food that just happen to be something.
So Butterscotch is kind of going back to your patisserie roots.
Yeah, it's going back to pastry. So yeah, it's quite fun. You get to play around, get to do some fun things with it. I just did a cake for the cover of Delicious Magazine this month, which was a carrot cake with a marble vanilla cheesecake center. It was a cover, couldn't believe it. Just kind of playing around, doing some fun stuff. Did a birthday cake for ASAP Rocky, for all you rap lovers out there. So that was pretty amazing.
Very exciting.
So just kind of some pretty fun things for Butterscotch. And now we have the tea room, of course, in Mayfair, which is like covered in these like giant paper flower walls. So you think Chanel, and like you kind of get a sense of what it's like. And kind of my return to afternoon tea, which is quite fun. So it's been a rewarding one. It's challenging and rewarding at the same time, because it's it's been 10 years since my first bakery.
Yes.
What's new, what's not new? What do people love still? And the intention for Butterscotch will always be that it's meant to kind of help create memories more than anything else, right? That you get a cake for birthdays. It can be a place for your first date, you know, it's a place for celebration. It's complementing and adding to and fulfilling those memories and building on those memories. And I think that's why I became a pastry chef in the first place, is I loved kind of connecting to people's memories in that sense. You know, most savory chefs, you know, they have their own vision, their own philosophy of how they want food to taste. But when you get to the higher level, it all comes back to, you know, I want food to evoke a feeling, and it's a feeling of positivity.
Okay.
And I think pastry chefs were always the originals in that. Pastry chefs, you know, you don't eat cake for sustenance.
Right.
You eat it to
you shouldn't. Sometimes maybe I do.
Right.
But
you eat it because you want to evoke a feeling more than anything else, and a happy feeling. You know?
More than pleasure. You think it's to elicit an emotion or a feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I think that's what pastry is all about. And so, so it's just something I've always gravitated to. And so it's returning to that's been quite fun.
Okay.
Challenging
okay.
and fun.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, you know, I think we were talking about this before I hit record, but maybe 10 years ago, before Bees came around, there wasn't anywhere to go on like a first date or just to meet someone that wasn't a pub. Kind of. I remember it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like this was just to let you guys know, Bees opened before there was Twitter or Instagram. So that gives you a sense of how old Bees was when it opened. Ancient. We had Square Mall Coffee. We were the first cafe to ever have Square Mall Coffee at the time.
Are you using Square Mall here?
Yeah, we're using, of course.
That's a good cup.
James and Annette. I can't imagine using anything else. And at the time, there weren't that many bakeries. There were definitely not that many cafes. I think at the time, you can count, Flat White, Clemson's and Sons, Monmouth, Yeah. And I think that was about it. I mean, you know,
they Soho were like anomalies.
They're anomalies,
Monmouth
yeah.
Monmouth was just like,
yeah, really yeah. Like Soho Grind hadn't opened yet, or Shoreditch Grind hadn't opened yet, Lantana hadn't opened yet, Notes hadn't opened yet, Ozone wasn't around yet. There are a lot of places that are around now and are ubiquitous. We're definitely not around at the time. Cake-wise, I think only Hummingbird Bakery, I think, was around at the time.
Right, yeah, okay.
Lola's opened after us. I think Patisserie Valley was around, but definitely no Princi, no, I mean, you know, certainly no Dominic Ansel. You know, yeah, we were it at the time. It was quite, yeah, even Violet Cakes hadn't been around yet. Yeah, I think it was just kind of still on the cusp of people were just about to learn American style treats and then also learning, you know, the Australian, you know, third wave kind of coffee. So yeah, it was definitely a very different landscape back then. Definitely peanut butter, I remember at the time, could be considered an exotic flavor.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, I remember, you know, you couldn't find big tubs of peanut butter back then. And if anytime we put anything like peanut butter out there, people got quite confused. And I think also everyone was quite traditional. So every year on the food media magazines, it was always the same cake every season. It was always a Victoria sponge in some shape or form. It was always like, you know, this type of treacle tart. It was always those kinds of things over and over and over again. Now, I mean, in the wake of, you know, Great British Bake Off and, you know, even just like, you know, the proliferation of Instagram and Twitter, I think in terms of the food knowledge that is being passed back and forth between and among countries has been able to increase the awareness of Londoners to appreciate new flavors. So, for example, when I first opened Bees, I remember that there was, I used to have like these yuzu pistachio macaron. And it was something I learned at Nobu, and I thought, oh yeah, people would love it. And they just looked at it like it was crazy. And back then, there's no way I didn't sell any, obviously. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I could do something like that, and it would be appreciated.
Yeah.
Whereas back then, it was like,
oh, where are the
strawberry tarts? Where's the Victoria sponge? You know, where's the treacle tart? It was very much, you had to kind of keep within the lines.
Okay.
And now it's incredible how, I mean, you can throw anything out there and people are willing to try it. And I think that's amazing. I think that's great.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
So you threw out there, you worked at Nobu as pastry chef.
I did.
Right before you did.
Right before I opened, yeah. Okay. And in fact, I'm still friends with Reggie Curzon, who is the still the executive pastry chef there.
Okay.
And he's just opened an incredible gelateria, actually, out in Battersea.
All right.
And does his own chocolates, which I sell on my website.
Okay,
butterscotchbakery.co.uk.
Okay.
Yep, and his place is called Sourced Cafe London. And it's just amazing. He taught me so much in terms of discipline and flavor. You know, that's not just about sugar.
Okay.
And I think one of the things that is very characteristic of Butterscotch Bakery more than anything else is that it's not just about sugar.
Okay.
It is about the flavor of what it is that you're trying to achieve. So we don't do the typical sugary American style frosting. It's actually a lighter Italian buttercream.
Awesome.
Which really just kind of is more about conveying the flavor that you're intending to convey.
Okay.
More than about having that sugar hit.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, Bees is really exciting for me, particularly considering our own history,
yes.
Going on a decade now,
yeah.
And your history with Bees of Bloomsbury,
yep.
And now your Soul Food Enterprises.
Yes.
So thank you for your time. What do you think is going to happen in the next 10 years?
For London?
You, London, food, whatever.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, I think. Hopefully, we won't be taken over by machines. That is my only hope for the next 10
really?
Years.
Okay.
Sushi robots. That's my biggest fear.
Okay. So handcraft.
Handcrafts.
Homemade.
Really caring about food supply more than anything else. Actually caring about where your food comes from.
Okay.
You know, really supporting British agriculture. I'm really kind of interested in that. I just took a course actually on ice cream manufacturing and dairy science in particular. And I really think that people undervalue the dairy industry in the UK. They won't bat an eyelid about paying £5 for a pint in a fancy London bar, but will balk at paying, you know, £1.10 a liter for good organic, sustainably sourced milk. And I think that I would love to see that change.
Okay, very, very cool. So if people are interested in having your amazing food, how can they find out about you online?
Yeah,
so
just go to feedyoursoul.co.uk. Look up Stax Diner, S-T-A-X, Boondocks, Famous Flames, or Butterscotch. We're all definitely there. Butterscotchbakery.co.uk with all your birthday cake needs. Got some pretty cool stuff on there. So.
Wonderful. Were you ready for some more Bodak Yellow?
Yes,
all
yes.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Cheers,
thank you so much.
I'm a boss to a worker, bitch. I make bloody moves. Bloody moves.